koyene façon eh mbale moi lu tombok tu yene façon eh ngoyene façon eh singe lu tombok tu yene façon eh.
For us in the West, Timbuktu is a byword for the ends of the earth, a mysterious backwater. But the city, which is in Mali, was founded in the 12th century, and during its peak, it was one of the academic and cultural centres of the world. That culture of learning still exists, and the city is home to a remarkable trove of books and manuscripts from the last 1,000 years. When jihadists invaded the city in 2012, the librarians and archivists of Timbuktu realised that those manuscripts were at risk and began the dangerous job of smuggling these treasures to safety. Joshua Hammer has documented their efforts in his new book, The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu. Here's Joshua speaking with Michael Cathcart.
Timbuktu, take us back to that golden age. What was it like?
Yeah, the golden age, well, the city was, as you point out, founded in the, I guess it would have been the 12th century, but it took a couple of hundred years before things really, momentum really built, and the city emerged as this center, not only of commerce, because it sat at a very strategic place at the highest bend of the Niger River, a vital artery through Africa, and the edge of the Sahara Desert, so camel caravans would come bearing goods from as far away as England across the Sahara. They would meet up with convoys of pirogues, of canoes coming up the river from sub-Saharan Africa. And Timbuktu was the natural meeting place. So it became this incredible center of commerce. And that kind of converged around, say, late 1400s, with a second kind of awakening, its emergence as a great cultural center. There were universities there. There was a very benevolent and philanthropic and intellectual king who ruled what was called the Songhai Empire at the time, which stretched really across that whole bulge of Western Africa. So he invited architects and scribes and poets and all sorts of intellectuals to converge on the city, and 50 centers of learning, something like 20,000 students, scribes turning out manuscripts, both original books and copies of books that were imported from Egypt, Damascus, Syria, Baghdad, Cairo, of course, other great centers of Islamic and Arabic learning. A lot going on for about 100 years.
And how does that intellectual energy and vibrancy, as you say, sit alongside the religious aspect or the religious dimension of the city?
That corner of the world, North Africa, the Sahel, the Maghreb, if you will, was always, until recently, really insulated from the kind of strict theological interpretation of Islam that was more centered in Saudi Arabia, in what would have been Arabia at the time. So they developed a reasonably moderate form of Islam. Sufism is the word that's used to describe much of that particular brand of Islam. And it was very much a mystical, open-minded religion that brought in secular ideas, that was open to secular ideas. There was no aversion to dancing, no aversion to singing. There were celebrations of the prophet's birthday and a lot of exuberance. And as I said, also an openness to secular ideas. So you had the literature that came out of the city really reflected that. For instance, you would have books about traditional medicine that would include both a set of prayers that you would say to cure yourself of various allergies or you name diarrhea, whatever, impotence, together with very practical, somewhat scientifically based advice about using plants, almost resembling sort of Chinese medicine, traditional medicine, using certain plants and minerals and things found in the desert and the semi-desert that could actually had some scientific base in being therapeutic. So they were able to weave these ideas together in a kind of seamless unity that was quite unique in the Islamic and the Arabic worlds.
All right, so those are the good old days. What sort of place is it today?
Well, it's a rather forlorn place. It had a brief period of cultural renaissance thanks to these librarians that you mentioned in the introduction. Around 1996 or so, there was a real push to rediscover the great old manuscripts of Timbuktu from that golden age, which involved going out into the desert and kind of tracking them down. Obviously, many of them had dispersed over the centuries. The hero of my book was the kind of inspiration behind all this. And he also had great connections, or developed great connections, to the Western funders, fundraisers. So he was able to get a lot of money, build libraries. The city kind of exploded with these libraries beginning around the year, I guess around 2000. And for a few years, money was pouring into Timbuktu from Ford Foundation in the U.S., from a lot of European foundations, from the Arab world. And so it became a kind of, I mean, I wouldn't say it was a return to the golden days, but it had a certain vibrancy and the tourists began to flock there as well. And also you had this music scene, this Malian music scene exploding at the time. So you had this kind of confluence of events that put it back on the cultural map, if you will, for a few brief golden years.
On Books and Arts, you're meeting Joshua Hammer, who's the author of The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu, talking to us from his home in Berlin. So this man you say is your hero is Abdelkader Haidara, who is a book collector, essentially, a man who goes out and finds collections of books, many of them in private hands.
That's right. His father was a scholar and a businessman in Timbuktu, and Abdelkader, and he ran a school. A madrasa, which was also open to all these different ideas. And Abdelkader grew up surrounded by these manuscripts, old dusty manuscripts that his father kept stashed away in a storage room and would bring out occasionally delicately and show it to the students. And they would sit around and read from them. And so Abdelkader grew up in this environment. He was tantalized by them. And when he got a bit older after his father's death, he inherited the family manuscript collection, which consisted of thousands of volumes, became the caretaker of that. And then he was asked by the government librarian, the head of a new library in Timbuktu, to go out on the road and kind of track down all these lost manuscripts from the Golden Age that I had mentioned, that had been dispersed into the desert. So he spent about 15 years really on this kind of amazing quest through the backcountry of Mali, which is a rough place, desert and mountains and very undeveloped. Would travel by camel and by canoe and go to these villages and cajole and persuade villagers to turn over their manuscripts to him for display and conservation in this government library. Gradually amassed thousands and thousands of volumes and really became very closely attached to them. I mean, it became his life's mission to find the books, to preserve the books, and to tell the world about the books. He felt extremely strongly that they presented, especially as, you know, after 9/11, when so much of the world developed this very negative view of Islam, he believed that these books showed a different side, a more gentle side, the open-mindedness of the Sufi tradition, and he wanted to show it to the world. So it became an all-consuming quest for him, and he was really quite successful at it.
So Joshua, I guess the fact that all these thousands of books and manuscripts have been brought together in one place into a library means that they're safe because they won't degenerate. You know, they're kept in conditions that are appropriate for that kind of material. But I guess it also makes them more vulnerable once the libraries themselves come under threat. Just tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, we should point out, yeah, there were a bunch of these libraries. The one he worked for, the government library, amassed about 25,000 volumes there. He started his own library. I mean, these are physical buildings in the city of Timbuktu, and raised money for others. So there were, by 2011, 2012, there were about 50 of these libraries. They range from simple small rooms to large structures like his own and like the government library. In 2012, partly as a result of the chaos unleashed by the Arab Spring, especially in Libya, you had this movement, jihadist movement, that had been developing over the years, kind of behind the scenes in the desert, suddenly had access to all of these weapons that had been basically let out of government control in the chaos of the Arab Spring and its aftermath. And they converged with a movement of Tuaregs, these kind of nomadic people of the Sahara, who wanted to create their own independent homeland, and they wanted the guns too. So everybody converged on these armories in Libya, grabbed these weapons, and then decided they were going to take over Mali. So they swept across the desert in the spring of 2012. The Malian army, which has, despite efforts over the years to train them, by the U.S. and by France really was a very feeble force, and they cut and ran really quickly. So the jihadists and their Tuareg allies were able to capture two-thirds of the country in the spring of 2012, and that included Timbuktu. And they declared themselves the new rulers of the city, declared Sharia law, began establishing this jihadist regime, didn't directly threaten to destroy the manuscripts at first, but certainly the alarm bells went off among the learned people, the librarians and the intellectuals of the city, who realized that these manuscript collections were certainly, and the vision that they presented was certainly incompatible with the jihadist ideology of the new occupiers of the city. So they realized they'd be in danger.
So your man, Abdelkader Haidara, your hero, decides to take action.
He did. And the first thing he did was to organize a kind of a nighttime movement of these books from the public libraries, where they would be easily tracked down and destroyed, to safe houses scattered around the city. So he had to do this at night, so to avoid detection by the jihadis, and they moved them all into these storage rooms around the city, just a small group of these librarians. They succeeded in doing that. They moved pretty much every collection into back rooms and basements. And they thought that would be enough. But things got more and more dangerous and unstable, and there was talk of a war, of a multinational force invading the city. The jihadis were ransacking houses and just behaving more and more aggressively. So they realized that Abdelkader realized that, and he was told by a lot of his donors, hey, we got to get them out of the city. So the next step in the operation began about 4 or 5 months into the occupation, and that involved a much more daring operation of actually taking these chests filled with books, trunks filled with books, and moving them down 550 miles from Timbuktu to government territory, the capital of Mali, down in government territory, a long trek across semi-desert, past checkpoints, and you know a lot of hair-raising episodes ensued as they tried to get them all out of the city before the jihadis got wise and started a destruction campaign.
So the jihadis didn't notice that the library shelves were emptying.
You know, it's hard to say what the jihadis noticed and what they didn't notice. Certainly there were, you know, a couple of arrests made where people were caught, you know, absconding with these books. Checkpoint a couple of times, guys were, they would look in the backs of these vehicles and find boxes of manuscripts. And turn the vehicle around, bring it to jihadi headquarters. But it doesn't seem like they ever kind of put two and two together and realized that there was this massive operation going on pretty much under their noses. And so nobody ever made a sort of massive crackdown on the smuggling operation, despite a couple of arrests and some threats. And, you know, there was an incident where a documentary team showed up in Timbuktu and wanted to film what was going on. So they came in, they wanted to go to the library. Jihadis escorted them into the library, forced their way inside, saw all these empty cases. Basically, the place had been swept clean, you know, by the smugglers. And just, they kind of looked around and said, where'd all the manuscripts go? And the caretaker who was involved in the smuggling operation just kind of played dumb. And, you know, I don't know, they must be, I think they were moved to people's houses for safekeeping because of the insecurity going on. And, you know, there was no follow-up. So somehow they were able to keep this operation going for the course of, 8 months or so.
And you say that there was a surprisingly positive side effect of the smuggling effort because the manuscripts were in some way described. They were documented.
That's true. That is one of the side effects because for the first time, I mean, Abdelkader Haidara himself had this collection of about 40,000 manuscripts. He had no idea what he had. I mean, he had a few volumes that he would show off on, you know, take out on exhibits around the world and stuff, but he had no inventory, he had no digital records, nothing. So as they packed these manuscripts at night, you know, burrowed away in the back rooms of these libraries, these secret packing, they would have to keep track of things because they had to, there was massive upheaval and everything, and the manuscript owners wanted their manuscripts back. And in the jumble of throwing these things into chests, they had to keep track of what they had. So this was the first kind of forced inventory that was made of all of these 350,000 manuscripts of Timbuktu. And the second good thing that happened was that it drew so much attention from the world that a real effort was made after the manuscripts were successfully removed to start digitizing and conserving and really kind of assessing by the outside world what was contained in these massive collections. And so a great effort is being made right now to conserve digitally and physically all of the great manuscripts of Timbuktu.
So where are they? Where are the physical books?
They're down in Bamako, which is the kind of dusty capital of Mali, in one large, after a series of moves where they were originally scattered in safe houses around the city, and then they were consolidated to like 10 different houses. And then a big American foundation came in and they built them a new facility. And that, from what I understand, I haven't been back to Bamako in 2 years, but I've heard this through the sources, including the foundation itself. There's a kind of a climate-controlled huge storage area where the manuscripts are being held until Abdul Qadir and the other librarians decide that Timbuktu is safe enough that they can begin transporting everything back and reopen the library.
Sounds like the final scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Joshua,
yeah, how do you...
have to wait a long, wait a while for that final scene to play out.
Joshua, how do you come to be telling this story? What's your investment in this?
I've always loved to travel and I've always been drawn to Africa, but I actually became Newsweek magazine's Africa bureau chief in the early 90s, and that's when I made my first trip to Timbuktu, and then I became a freelance writer 10 years later. I noticed a short article about these manuscripts being rescued in those days. This is the early efforts, you know, to conserve them, and that's when I pitched it as a freelance magazine piece, and I went to Timbuktu in 2006, and that's where I met Abdul Qadir Haider for the first time and wrote a long article about him, and I just kind of kept up with it. And so when I got to know people in Mali, and I made a few trips back there. I got into the music. And then in 2012, when the jihadis took over, of course, I paid a lot of attention to that. And gradually, I discovered about this rescue effort. I mean, I wasn't the only one to discover it. It was a couple of other journalists who knew about it, actually before I did. But, you know, then I actually decided to really investigate it in depth and make it not only about the manuscripts and the rescue operation, but about Abdul Qadir and his incredible life story. You know, he's just a really dynamic, fascinating character himself. So he was a great person to hang the tail on, you know, because he's so charismatic and energetic.
Joshua Hammer speaking with Michael Cathcart. And his book, The Badass Librarians of Timbuktu, is published by Allen & Unwin.